Also, I'm the executive director of the Northwestern Buffett Institute for Global Affairs, and welcome once again to our webinar series, Building Sustainable Futures, Global Challenges and Possibilities. In this series, we focus every quarter on a different United Nations Sustainable Development Goal. And this quarter, we're focusing on SDG number 16, which is Peace, Justice, and Strong Institutions. So earlier this month, we were delighted to have Professor Barnard Hesse, who spoke about the role of foundational liberal claims to liberty and equality in maintaining white sovereignty and the structural law of racial rule and racial violence. And today, our topic is everyday experiences of violence in Syria and Lebanon and the forms of regional and international intervention that sometimes perpetuate rather than alleviate such violence. And our wonderful speakers are also in a position to talk about how people imagine their futures amid that kind of instability and how they find in it all possibilities for transformative change. So to talk about all this, we're just delighted to have two wonderful, wonderful speakers with us today. Dr. Sami Hermes is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Acting Director of the Liberal Arts Program at Northwestern University in Qatar. He's the author of War is Coming: Between Past and Future Violence in Lebanon. And he's currently completing a manuscript entitled Serene, A Palestinian Story of Dispossession and Resistance, which is under contract with Stanford University Press. Sami's research focuses on questions of violence, affect, and temporality, and the ways in which those play out in everyday life. We also have with us Dr. Samer Aboud, who is Associate Professor of Global Interdisciplinary Studies at Villanova University and the author of Syria. He completed his doctorate in Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter, where he conducted research on marketization in Syria. And Samer is currently working on a manuscript titled The Struggle for the New Arab State, Postcolonialism, Privatization, and Political Change in the Arab World, which explores how different modes of privatization create conditions of possibility for new forms of political agency. Just delighted to have you both. Thank you very much for your time. Welcome, and we look forward to hearing from you. And I should say, if anyone has questions, just post them in the chat and we will put them before our speakers after they finish their initial comments. And I think, Samer, we're gonna start with you, right?
Yes, we are. Thank you so much, Annalise. Thank you, Ariel, for the invitation. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you to Sami for organizing this. I was going to start with a joke about having a 20th century presentation because I don't have any PowerPoints, but that doesn't really work since we're doing it on WebEx. So I'll be talking for about 12 minutes and then passing the floor to Sami. My interest today, and I think our collective interest, is in considering what it means to talk about the proliferation of violence, insecurity, and crisis in the Arab region. What we're calling ecologies of crisis is the product of intersecting conflicts and practices that prevent people from within the region from articulating, let alone achieving, any sense of collective security. So in my brief time today, I want to discuss how I understand these ecologies of crisis, as well as ask what the prospects are for unraveling the entanglements that produce them. In a general sense, ecologies of crisis are produced and sustained through competing visions of regional order. These visions produce patterns of conflict from within the region and from without through the violent intervention of outside actors. The hollowing out of authoritarian governance and the role of the state in the region as the producer of insecurity and not collective security have provided the conditions of possibility for the continued penetration of the region and the spreading of crisis, violence, and insecurity. The question of what regional order should look like represents a conundrum produced by these conflicting visions of what threat and security mean in the region. And these conflicting visions induce securitizing actors to adopt policies that produce insecurity for others. So there's an absence of a common definition of internal security and external threat. And this opens up the space for radically different security and insecurity reference. These fragmented regional visions are generative of crisis. This is how one of the principal sort of foundations of these ecologies is these conflicting visions and the policies that they produce. And the, of course, the violence and actions that they produce from different actors. Climate change, economic collapse, and of course the COVID-19 pandemic all graft onto this regional order and subject peoples to an unending series of crises for which there appears no end in sight. The Syrian conflict for me sits at the epicenter of the region's crisis ecologies, and the absence of a resolution to the conflict, indeed the conditions for its persistence, reveal two features or problems of the current regional order. The first is the problem of desecuritization, or how states and actors can contribute to reducing and acting upon threats. The second problem is the absence of a normative framework that could transition away from persistent conflict to an untangling of crisis. So what are the conditions under which these actors could negotiate and could deliberate over a different kind of regional order? So this is, again, of course, to ask how a common normative structure could emerge that fosters dialogue and deliberation between different actors in the region. Given our time limitations, I want to kind of focus on the second issue about the normative framework. Crisis ecologies persist because of an emergent normative order that disincentivizes securitizing actors to engage in deliberation and negotiation, and thus the desecuritization of threats. In Syria, we see the emergence of such an order reflected at both the domestic and the regional levels, where illiberal norms are advanced by both the Syrian regime and the tripartite Astana process powers, Russia, Turkey, and Iran. Both the regime and these external actors are advancing different kinds of illiberal norms as a method of conflict resolution. The Astana process emerged in parallel to the United Nations-led Geneva process. Astana essentially aims to create a post-conflict Syria that submits Syrian sovereignty to the negotiation and consensus of the tripartite powers. Since its creation in 2017, so it's relatively new, since its creation, it's effectively supplanted Geneva as the main mechanism for regional deliberation over how to resolve the Syrian conflict. The norms advanced by the Astana process do not provide prospects for regional desecuritization, but actually serve to perpetuate crisis and insecurity. This order is emerging through a negotiated vision that seeks the management of the Syrian battlefield, through the perpetuation of external influence on armed groups as the core goal of deliberation. So it's really, it begins as a battlefield agreement, and it, at its core, is a battlefield agreement about how to manage different armed groups on this in Syria. The ultimate aim of Astana is thus not to eliminate violence, but rather to manage it by creating battlefield conditions for the negotiation over who gets to exercise authority over what territory, who can influence what actors, what counts as permissible violence, and so on. At the same time that these external actors have negotiated the Syrian battlefield and what violence looks like on this battlefield, the Syrian regime has passed a series of citizenship, property, and residency laws, that effectively denationalize large segments of the Syrian population who cannot prove their loyalty to the regime under the guise of settling the status of civilians and reconciling with former fighters. So in place of a domestic peace process, what the Syrian regime has done is establish a judicial process for determining who is and isn't a terrorist in Syria. So for people who are known to have fought with armed groups, they can engage in a process of what's called reconciliation, where they can kind of renounce terrorism and submit to the authority of the state and often be integrated into the counterinsurgency apparatus. That doesn't always end well. In the case of civilians, especially civilians who have left the country, there's been a new law in Syria passed that defines terrorism as not just an act of violence, but as any act that is against the state, that is deemed subservient to state interests. And that can include a Facebook post or anything that happens online. It certainly includes protests and so on. So in order for many Syrians, civilians, to settle their status with the regime, they need to prove that they have not engaged in any quote-unquote terrorist activity. And what this effectively does is bifurcate Syrian society into the loyal and to the disloyal. The normative order in the region today generates political options and processes and projects such as Astana, or the regime settlement and reconciliation process. In other words, the regional order produces the conditions for the continuation of war through these mechanisms. It provides the conditions for the advancement of illiberal norms in Syria. For Syrians caught within the ecologies of crisis, there's very little escape from any of the political processes aimed at creating a post-conflict order. I don't want to express nostalgia for liberal intervention, and I'm certainly not in any way expressing nostalgia for that. But it's important to point out something that should be obvious from my discussion here, that liberal principles around deliberation, power sharing, negotiation, resource distribution, anything of the sort, are simply not on offer for Syrians today. As for many people within the region, their entanglement in ecologies of crisis raise serious questions about the future of collective security. Who will provide vaccines when they are available? Who will ensure that the displaced have rights? How can people's economic livelihoods be secured? The region's crisis ecologies reinforce an order that creates rather than answers these questions. So it is productive of more and more insecurity and crisis. In place of security and safety, the emergent order, this so-called peace, as the tripartite powers and the regime are calling it, is producing conditions of persistent and generational violence. The Astana process and the Syrian regime's new legal regimes around citizenship and property ensure that for many Syrians, the coming decades will resemble the previous decade, defined by having to navigate these intersecting crises. To conclude, I believe that how the Syrian conflict is being resolved is in a way that will ensure its perpetuation. What is happening in Syria today is a process that will repackage the war. It will create a legal system that punishes dissent and disloyalty, will foreclose a future for young Syrians, and produce a political economy that rewards the conflict elite and the warlords for their loyalty to the regime during the conflict. This new order will be underpinned by both external control by the tripartite powers and Syria's continued exclusion from the international community. In this context, the Syrian conflict will fuel regional ecologies of crisis rather than contribute to their alleviation. Thank you.
Thank you, Samir. Thank you, Annalise and the Buffett Institute and Ariel and all the organizers for putting this together and for inviting us. I wanted to pick up from where Samir left off on this sort of entanglement between peace process or the Astana process and war. Not as opposites, but as entanglements, in that certain conceptions of peace, certain ways of thinking about it, drive or mutate or indeed perpetuate war. And so I'm going to start there, and then I'll say some words about living in or living with crisis before returning to the role of the international in these crisis ecologies. And some of what I'm going to talk about here comes from a forthcoming piece that I'm writing for the project on Middle East political science. So what Samir is speaking of can really be seen in the so-called end of Lebanon's war, the war between 1975 and 1990. And you can kind of see, so we were talking before, sorry, we were talking before about not getting interrupted by your kids, and I'm just getting interrupted by my kids. what emerges is not peace, but a continuation of war through peace or through politics or a reframing of the social, political, and economic relations embedded in war as normal, peaceful life. And this is sort of what you see at the end of Lebanon's war. What the Ta'if peace agreement, for example, did was to bracket the war as past, as something without structural effects. What we find, however, is that it was anything but that, because the war continued, literally, physically, in that, you know, you had Israeli occupation, you had bombings, you had Syrian tutelage, and a number of other sort of physical kind of violence, but also structurally. The Ta'if Agreement, as Robert Meister writes about human rights discourse more generally, worked to place the evil of war in the past, no longer understood as having ongoing structural effects, even after the structure of war is supposedly dismantled. So, but what happens after is that with every explosive event, people are reminded that they, in fact, live in a continual war. They are reminded of what Samer just alluded to, of a peace that produces conditions of persistent and generational violence. Continual war here, of course, and the way I'm talking about it isn't to exceptionalize the region or Lebanon. It's, you know, in another way you can, or I guess in a, you could say that there's no better way of framing U.S. history, in fact, as engaged in a continual war in the drive towards empire and towards building empire. So this isn't to exceptionalize Lebanon in any way. The continual war I speak of is continual because its roots are the same. So, for example, you have Israeli occupation of Palestine and aggression on Lebanon and the related effects as one significant node that continues before, during, after, if you want to break up the periods in that way. Political sectarian power sharing that's set up in the time of the French Mandate is another node. A patronage system that's subsidized through economic corruption is a third, and we can talk about a number of other sort of roots. But it's these continual roots that bring about this feeling of being stuck. And so in the last year, the October 17 uprising was meant to sort of end this continual war by cutting off at least two of these three nodes, if you will. So political sectarianism and the patronage system. But the uprising, as we know, is thus far, we could say, failed or hasn't achieved or brought about any material change. Or sort of achieved any of the demands of the uprising or revolution. Nevertheless, it has created a change in people's mindsets. So definitely don't want to kind of detract from that kind of real impact in that sense. But the potentiality of hope last October has not given rise to a consolidated kind of opposition or new parties that could change the course of the regime. And it may feel, in fact, eventful in that there is a before and after, before October 17 and after October 17. But in some sense, the eventfulness of the event can't really be detached from the sense that it's also the day, I guess conveniently for the ruling class, in a sense, when the lira began to die. Right. So I think there's this feeling that, you know, it was, I think if you ask anyone, the economic collapse was happening before. But there's a sense or like a feeling that, you know, that the revolution is what brought that about, which, I mean, I disagree with, but that's kind of, I think, a feeling that also separates us kind of before and after. So along with the uprising came the worst economic crisis that Lebanon's experienced in the last 30 years, or since Lebanon's war between 75 and 1990. And I'm not going to get into this much, but the crisis, surely a function of the corruption of the government and banking system, is also a function of international politics, international donor structures, and U.S. sanctions on Syria and Hezbollah. So these ecologies of crisis, the multiple layers interacting and entangled, somehow culminate in the Beirut port explosion of August 4. And by all accounts, it seems to have been an act of incompetence. But incompetence is deeply political. So let's not be fooled by the word incompetence. And so as I've been thinking about this lately and for this talk, we find ourselves in Lebanon stuck, right? And people have written about this. Maysoon Sakaria has written an article about this. People are stuck in motion, if you can imagine what, being stuck in motion, like those movies where the hero is tied to or stuck on a speeding train heading for doom. After the blast, people are still reeling, gutted, heartbroken. Still, they feel the blast in their bodies. Realizing we're still reeling, still in war, jolts us into the sense that we are living in crisis, as Julia Derdiri and I call it. This article we publish in Cultural Anthropology, where crisis is chronic yet remains imagined, desired, and often articulated as an exception. In the days after the explosion, how I heard still hear that we have not hit rock bottom, simultaneously in crisis and waiting for it to come or to intensify. Ironically, I would argue that this idea that crisis is both lived and also imagined as something to come is a source of security in insecure times, a way for people to live in crisis and stay sane, make meaning out of their present. As Kali Rubai has said through her findings in Iraq, it's a way of living in which people sort of steal each day. If the crisis is tomorrow, then they're living to have a day today better than tomorrow, rather than thinking how we often do of a day better than today. Right, so hope in a sense is in today, almost in like the despair of today, but seeing some sort of hope emerging that it's better than tomorrow, and living in that way. So while violence is all around, while we can find it in incompetence, in government corruption, in a lack of accountability, and all the usual ways, it's also not exceptional. More importantly, if we think of the theme of these webinars and the sustainable goals, they're also not local. And here's the final point I want to raise. These forms of violence that Lebanon is reeling from, that Yemen and Syria and Palestine and Iraq and are suffering from, they are always already wrapped in international intervention. Corruption is not a local matter. Incompetence is not a local matter. In the U.S., you speak of interference in your elections, but the U.S. interferes in every detail of our lives, from our elections to the choosing of our leaders, to our economies. It doesn't care whether our leaders or our system is sectarian. It cares whether we are pro-American, and perhaps more so that we are pro-Israel, and we are asked to surrender to Israel for aid. So the fantasy of it all is that many Americans believe that democracy at home translates to democracy or democracy promotion abroad or democratic policy abroad. But the U.S. is uninterested in democracy abroad. And I mean, perhaps in these days, even locally, because it governs along the principle of democracy at home and fascism abroad. It borrows this, I would argue, from colonial Britain and France before it. And so when we, and now I mean you and me and us here in this audience, when we think of violence and we focus on government corruption and incompetence and even the corruption and repressiveness of Hezbollah, that terrifying group who has no friends other than a sanctioned country and a war-torn one, we need to rethink our priorities. We need to think where the catastrophic violence comes from. Who is sovereign today? Who really can give us life and let us die? Hezbollah, Iran, the Lebanese prime minister or president, or the US, the French, the Russians, the international community? These local, ever-evolving and multi-layered crises, these crisis ecologies that Samer speaks of, are always already marked by international intervention. And these interventions can come in the form of ground troops, or they can come in the form of peace processes. But we need only turn to the history of settler colonialism, especially to its history in the US, to recognize that peace processes and peace treaties have historically been wrapped in the proliferation of violence rather than its absence. We need only ask Native peoples from America to Palestine when they lost much of their land to understand that there is a world, a very real world, in which war is peace, in which a time period marked as peace is really but a proliferation of violence by other means. And so war is peace is not the peace anyone wants to really settle for. I'll end there. Back to you, Annelies.
Thank you both so much. As two wonderful talks that come at things from connected but slightly different methodological directions, I think. And what you've given us, you were talking about the multi-layered crises. I almost felt we had a multi-layered conversation about multi-layered crises. So that was great. So there's so much here that we can talk about. I mean, maybe we could begin with how people respond to the environment of multi-layered crisis. Samer, you talked a little bit about this, Sammy raised the idea of hope, and you know, I think hope is really different from optimism, right? Because optimism is you think things are going to get better no matter what. Hope sometimes exists when one has no optimism whatsoever about the future, but one nevertheless has an ability to move on and make something out of the cultural material that's around one, even when it is so difficult. So how do you see hopeful, not optimistic, but hopeful creative or transformative work do you see ordinary people doing with the political, symbolic, and economic, and military material that defines our world right now?
I can start, I guess. It's really hard. I mean, I think one always obviously has to have hope and so on. And I think in light of the Beirut port blast, it's really at least for a Lebanese to have hope, or at least for me, not to speak for everyone. And I think what's been interesting for me is to actually think through despair. And obviously, we can say that you can't really. Hope sort of in some ways emerges from despair, right? You don't need hope if there's no despair. But also to think about this kind of in a sense we're talking about multi-layers, but the multi-layers of despair and what emerge from those moments of despair. As I was thinking about this, and I've been trying to write about it a little bit, I keep drowning in that despair. And then you realize, actually, for example, like even in the immediate aftermath of the explosion in Beirut, people took to the streets to clean up, there were people protesting throwing nooses on bridges to like they wanted to hang their leaders and kind of with this anger. And so as much as rhetorically people talk about being dead inside, and people are in a sense dead inside, but there are these sort of rhetorically talking about feeling stuck and feeling sort of still in this crisis, in these kind of multi-layers of tragedy, there is a way in which people do in ways that are hopeful in the ways that their rhetorical speech acts, I guess, don't actually match, I think. And I think there's hope in that, right? That if you listen to people, you hear despair, but if you actually see the way they move in the world, you see hope. I think if you see sort of those two multiple levels. You're muted, Annalise.
Sorry, I just said that makes perfect sense. Thank you. Summer, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. One of the reasons why I'm actually Lebanese, but I did my research on Syria. And I think one of the reasons why I loved Sammy's book is that it helped me explain every conversation I've had with a family member. It was a really great way to explain this kind of being stuck, this relationship between hope and despair, which I think really speaks to my own feelings and my family's feelings. I will say just what I can add to Sammy's comment is that often lost in the analysis on Syria is what Syrians are doing and how Syrians are responding to this, including my introduction here, my comments. And I will say that, of course, there's been a proliferation of cultural production, of kind of memory making that makes sense of the conflict, that makes sense of people's experience, both inside and outside of Syria. And I think that that, of course, is very plural and looks different, whether inside or outside of the country. And so I think there's, of course, that which is often invisible to us. But I do think that inside of the country, there are also ways that many of the people who we might have considered to be part of the opposition, or you know, this gray area between regime and opposition, that are working within local centers of power, the way that that power is kind of organized in local areas in Syria to try and improve very local conditions. And I'm thinking things here like really granular things like sorting out property rights, reconciling between families and communities. These things are certainly happening in the country. And I do think that not all hope is lost. There are, despite everything that the regime is doing, despite what is happening at the level of Astana, I do believe that there are many ways politically, socially, artistically, that Syrians are trying to make sense of the world and trying to, in a sense, envision a different future. Maybe not one that was, based on the ideals of 2011, on the uprising, but something different than what is coming now. But I actually just this morning in my class, we were talking about violence and mobility and using cases from Syria to think about the language that people use to describe their movement outside. And I think that these experiences are very individualized. They're dependent on people's inability to access rights and security when they leave Syria or when they're inside of Syria. So I think that the question of response is a really dynamic one, but it's certainly, you know, it's not this like, I like that stuck in motion. You know, there is a sense of being stuck, but something is happening as well.
Being stuck in motion, absolutely. Summer, we have a question from you. Professor Danny Pulsell asks, says that your analysis brings to mind what the Syrian writer Yassin Al-Haj Salel has called the Syrianization of the world. And he'd be interested in hearing you say a bit more about why you think the Syrian tragedy carries wider global lessons and what those lessons are.
Thank you, Professor, for the question. That's a really great one. Although I'm familiar with Yassin's work, I'm not sure that I quite remember that that work on Syrianization of the world. So my reflection is based on the question, not any knowledge of Saleh's work. For me, and I think one thing that is frightening to me about what we're seeing in Syria is that the advancement of illiberal practices, or there's a kind of advancement of illiberal norms alongside illiberal practices, that as violence proliferates in Syria, there isn't really a reference point for resolving the many legacies of the conflict, the many after effects. So, you know, I keep coming back to this question of who gives Syrians rights? Who is there anybody who can provide collective security or collective rights for Syrians? And I think that the fact that we don't have an answer to that, the way that Sammy answered at the end, listing all of these countries whose interventions have been consequential on the lives of Lebanese and Syrians, that none of those interventions, none of those actors, none of the policies adopted by them help advance collective security, help advance a future filled with hope. And I think that that is really frightening, because we see the kind of transfer of this model, say to Libya and to perhaps Armenia and Azerbaijan, where there's conflict, where the means of resolving the conflict, nobody's pretending to even want to solve them. It's actually about kind of managing them and ensuring their continuity in a way. And in that, I think the people who are most affected by these conflicts live in this kind of space without rights, space without a sense of security or safety. So I think that's certainly one. I don't want to go so as far so far as to say it's, you know, the death of liberalism or the death of liberal order or whatever, but it certainly means something about the hegemony of liberal power and what is coming and a potential alternative. That's number one. The other thing that I think, you know, I wonder what the category of refugee will look like in 50 years. And whether we'll even have that as a kind of subjectivity in the world. Because if what we're seeing in the case of Syria is a kind of complete enclosure of the rights of the displaced. And I don't think that's exceptional to Syria. I think if we look at the trajectory of the global refugee rights regime, it starts out expansively and contracts. Just today, I read that since 2000, the United States has only taken in 33,000 Iraqi refugees, and I'm sure most of them were against the will of the government. And you know that we live in a world that is producing immense violence, that is producing crisis, pandemics. Climate change is affecting people's lives, and people are on the move because of this. People are trying to flee these situations. Syrians are no different. Syrians are experiencing all of this. This is why I use the language of ecologies of crisis. The problem is that at the same time that that is happening, we're not seeing an expansion of the rights of the displaced. And I think that what we're seeing happening in the Syrian case perhaps kind of predicts a future that isn't very very friendly towards the displaced.
That was a sobering response. So let's see, we have a question from Professor Jessica Winiger. She says, hi, Samer and Sami, wonderful to see you. I'm curious if in the cases of Lebanon and Syria, you see frustration as an affect related to ecologies of crisis. And if so, what the political possibilities of that affect might be? I ask because in my own work in Egypt, I noted frustration and fed upness, Arabic Zahaf, as a mobilizing affect both before and after the 2011 uprisings. Frustration, is that a powerful concept for you?
Sammy, do you want to go ahead?
I'm thinking it's a good one, and I feel like frustration. Frustration is produces anger. But I feel like the frustration, but in this case, I'm thinking out loud here, but I feel like frustration also is kind of produces paralysis in a sense, because when it's kind of multiple rounds of especially like, you know, in the aftermath of the October 17 revolutions and this kind of euphoria, and then, the ruling class kind of reconsolidates or is kind of just rooted in the ground and digs its feet. And then you kind of think, oh, something's going to happen, and nothing sort of changes. And And then you overlay that with the economic kind of disintegration and then COVID and then the blast. And so these kind of rounds of things, because when COVID, even with the economic crisis, there were kind of ebbs and flows, there's ups and downs. And then COVID hit. And right after COVID, then people came out on the streets, not right after COVID, we're still in the COVID period, but there was a moment like in June, July, when in Lebanon, things kind of got better because they didn't have many cases. And so people kind of took to the streets again, and then you have this blast. And this blast I think I would say, just, you know, preliminary thoughts, is there's this kind of paralysis that I see from this frustration. But it's a good question. I mean, I would need to think a little bit on that.
Okay, thank you. So another question is about how private crisis turns into collective crisis. So how does the private experience of mourning, for example, become collective or political in your experience? Or how does a private experience of injustice against an individual body become collectivized or politicized in either Syria or Lebanon? And what can that tell us about collective responses to political crisis, or perhaps even transformations of those? Hard question, sorry.
Sammy, do you want to start, or do you want me to?
If you have a response to that.
I have a response. I'm not sure if it's a good one.
Go for
I
it.
Have a response. first, hi, Jessica. The frustration question was really great, and I want to kind of think about it. So my response is based on something that I was just kind of thinking about and writing about briefly yesterday, that I think there's a very interesting appropriation of. So I'm thinking in Morocco, when the fish seller in 2016 was crushed to death by the state, where they put him in one of the garbage. If you're familiar with that story, he's in a village. And he was illegally selling fish, and they put him in one of the garbage compressors, and he died. He was killed by the state. And I'm thinking of the language now in Tunisia, but there was a 19-year-old man who was forced to jump in water, and he told the police that he couldn't swim. And so he said to them, "I can't swim." So this has become a rallying cry. And I think we certainly saw this at the beginning of the uprising, where there was a kind of every person, a kind of archetypal subject that was produced out of these conditions that was used, I think, certainly in social media, but certainly as a, you know, this, there was this language of we are, you know, we are this person who suffered, we are this person's experience. And I think that that's continued today. I mean, certainly in Tunisia, that's happening now. There's sort of graffiti about this all over the place. And it's become a way that this person's individual experience with the state, with the violence of the state, is taken on as representative of the collective. So I hope that answers the question a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think also one thing to add to that is to think about which lives get publicly kind of mourned and collectively mourned, and which lives don't, which lives become, right, political deaths and which aren't. And I think it's also interesting to see how the Beirut blast victims get, in some ways, I don't know, I have to think about this more, but like there isn't this grand political mourning of the lives, and that I think one would expect, and partly because, I don't know, seen as this kind of political incompetence, and there was this moment of, you know, the blast was so immense that the focus was on that kind of devastation. But at the same time, and I think there was this moment of anger, and people, you know, trying to take to the streets. But even that wasn't like, you didn't get a million people taking to the streets after that, right? People were kind of distraught and devastated, and kind of that feeling of dead inside. They didn't feel that, you know, there's this kind of energy to go out. But I think I wanted to add that it's interesting, these moments, like the Moroccan fish seller becomes a kind of political or political death and a kind of collective mourning. You're muted.
I'm sorry. Summer, just a quick follow-up. You mentioned social media. I mean, what is your view on the way that new media technologies are impacting the way we turn individual experiences of violence or crisis into larger political causes or experiences?
That's a great question. I think, you know, my kind of anecdotally grounded response is that it actually produces more ambiguity than truth in a way. I think that, you know, there's a kind of, I think there's a, I don't want to say a kind of undermining, but I think that, you know, my experience is that, you know, through, say, WhatsApp groups or Facebook or Twitter or, you know, these sorts of things that we all consider social media, that in the beginning of the Syrian conflict, it was a way to circulate truth. And it was a way to circulate, you know, some idea of what was happening, what was true, what was going on. But I think that now there isn't quite the same kind of, I don't know, you know, I don't want to say the holiness of that, but I do think that there are many strategies that are used by different Syrians, not just people associated with the regime or not or whatever, but and I think that creates a kind of, like, it unsettles truth in a way, but it also, like, more importantly, I think it unsettles certain political narratives. And I think, you know, this idea that there's a massive gray zone in Syria, I think is actually very true, because many people don't fall kind of very ideologically on either side, at least in my reading of the situation. Yeah, I think I don't have the best answer to that question, because I've seen a kind of trajectory of how social media was used, I think, in the beginning of the uprisings versus now. Certainly in Syria, I mean, I think that there was this kind of project to communicate truth to the world, that there was a necessity of kind of circumventing the regime's hold of the narrative of what was happening in the country. And I know from the many WhatsApp groups that I've now muted that, you know, this is how, you know, people would circulate videos, pictures, things like this. Family feuds would take place over, at least in my family, over imagery and things like this. So I think that the kind of political outcome of that now is very different than it was at the beginning. You know, I remember, for example, in my family, that when people would exchange videos of what was happening, what, say, the Syrian army or police or wherever security agents were doing, that people would call them doctored and call them, you know, say they were fake. And, you know, so there was this kind of, I think, a battle over truth. And now I'm not sure who needs to be convinced, you know, where that battle. So social media takes on, I think, for me, at least in the Syrian case, a very different role in also about learning what's happening inside of the country. I don't think it's as public. Information coming out of the country now is not as public as it once was at the beginning.
So, Sami, we have a question from you for you from Dean Marwan Crady. He's asking about the concept of despair that you have given us. Says, I was very struck by this concept of despair. Is despair, politically speaking, a terminal affect? What's the temporality of despair? Does it lead only to exit, such as immigration, or to resignation, or are there other effects of despair, temporally speaking?
Yeah, thanks, Dean Marwan, for that question. I think certainly there. So this is what I think I was trying to say is that there are multiple layers of despair, and so certainly, you know, you can see one of those manifestations in the example you gave, that the immigration being one of those. But I think, and there is this sense of the despair that I was talking about, of feeling sort of dead inside, that you hear, that I've heard quite a bit. But I think also that that there is something more to be untangled in that sort of feeling of despair, what I was trying to get at is that there is this, people are continuing to do things, right? And people are, there is life in Lebanon, right? And people are still organizing, new organizers come into the fold of this uprising as other people kind of take a step back. People are opening new businesses, surprisingly, right? And people are still trying to find work and to survive, and they're doing different things, all within, I would say, despair, right? Those people are not miraculously just like not feeling that despair. They are feeling that despair, but there are all these other things that are kind of happening alongside that. So I think it would be a mistake to kind of predetermine the effects of despair, right? Or to overdetermine the effects of despair, that there are, that it can lead to sort of many things, and one of those is hope, right? I'm seeing here despair very much entangled with hope, that those things are not actually things that you can sort of separate. So that's, I guess, one of those, I guess, what gives me hope, I suppose, is to sort of try to look at it in that way. And the temporality issue, I think, is also really important, is that these things are also not static, right? So I think the immigration is not necessarily just despair, but it's opportunity, right? So if I find an opportunity, I might take it. And if I have an opportunity to leave the US, I might take it, or Qatar, right? So it's not necessarily that, people leave also for multiple reasons. And it's not like when they leave that despair automatically disappears. And they continue to live with that despair even after they immigrate, I think.
That's really helpful. And one of the things that I find very powerful about your analysis, Sunny, is kind of empathetically trying to give despair its due, though, in that moment of despair, and not saying, oh, it just becomes hope, so we can functionally imagine what the next stage of it is, but to really understand what that feels like in the moment for the people that you're working with. So I really appreciate that. So we have a cluster of other questions that I want to pose together and get your reactions to. So a question is about your use of the word regime, like what is a regime, what is a state, if either of you have comments on that. The other is about institutional corruption. Sami, you mentioned the power of corruption and that it's not just an accident or what have you. How does that ever change is the question. What are the first steps beyond to turn that endemic problem of corruption around? And a third question is about the fact that it seems like in this conversation, when we talk about positive elements, positive social factors, we're talking about local communities inside. And when we're talking about negative elements, we're often talking about external foreign forces. Is there any way that that analysis needs to be more complicated, that there might be positive and negative, both internally and externally? So just throw that bunch out and let you respond in any way you like.
I can respond quickly to these. One, for me, regime and state, I mean, there's surely analytical ways of thinking about this. I think they're very political. Designations, I think, a regime is a state and that you don't like, I suppose. Perhaps all states should be considered regimes. The second one, I know because we're out of time, I think corruption in some ways, maybe this is too controversial, but it's somewhat of a liberal kind of way of looking at the conflict. And I think the way to deal with the situation, I think, demands some form of revolutionary thinking. And I think that, in Lebanon, sure, corruption, but we have corruption in the U.S., you have corruption in all kinds of places. It's much more about this political sectarian system that kind of seeps in and everywhere and creates forms of elite kind of partnerships and alliances at the expense of the population and turns us against each other. And the last thing I want to say quickly on the inside, outside, who's I think for me, it's also about who's my audience today, right? So this is presumably an international audience. I think what people don't hear about is the role of the international and international intervention. I mean, yeah, sure, amongst myself and other Lebanese, there's a whole lot of things I could say about the problems in Lebanon, about the problems with, you know, the different political parties and so on. But I think it's really important also in terms of what can people in the audience think about and do and use their voices for, is this sort of international and thinking about the role of the international. Sam.
Just very quickly again, that question of what's the regime, what's the state was the first question I asked my PhD advisor, I think. His response was there's a regime and there's a state. And that's sort of, I think, my response. You know, the state I think of as the kind of complex of institutions and the public sector responsible for the governance of a country. The regime is where the centers of power lie and where decisions about violence are taken, decisions about subjecting people to social or physical death are taken, where economic resources are concentrated and decisions about that made. So I think of, you know, for me, there is a distinction, for example, between the Syrian regime and the Syrian state. Even though they're obviously very, very intertwined, and the project of the last umpteen years has been to render them indistinguishable in some ways, and it's not complete. But so that for me is the distinction. I think Sammy's defer to Sammy on the question of corruption and endemic corruption. Just say this about the positive, negative, inside, outside. Yeah, I think it's important not to romanticize the inside and romanticize the local, because what we see actually now in international interventions, kind of non-military interventions, peace interventions, development interventions, is that there is this idea that that which is local is somehow pure and honest, and it's kind of autonomous from power. And so what you do is, rather than working, intervene through the state, you intervene through local centers of power. And what we find is that local centers of power are just as oppressive, unequal, violent, whatever, as kind of federal centers of power. I certainly don't want to kind of romanticize that which is local, but in terms of external interventions into the region, you know, of course, there are hundreds of thousands of people now whose lives are dependent on forms of external intervention, aid, food, homes, things like that. And of course, that sustains life in some way. My concern is more about what kind of life is being sustained, and how those lives are subject to like a kind of form of slow social death, right? That there isn't a kind of like what's on the horizon for these lives that are sustained. And that's not to, I mean, it's to suggest that even the forms of intervention that help sustain life need to be much more productive and positive on the lives of people than they are. In military intervention, the intervention of the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, sanctions, all of these forms of intervention are completely detrimental to people's lives. They're awful. And I mean, they're just, they're brutal. Sanctions are brutal. They're crippling. They kill people. They don't do what we think they do. And so I do think that, of course, there is nuance in the internal and external, but to kind of support Sammy's point, that for many of us who live outside of these places that are affected by it, I think it's important that we understand critically what states and international organizations are often doing in our name, in a way.
Super helpful. Thank you very much for that clarification. This has been really tremendous. Just a really very, very subtle, complex, empathetic, and yet sobering analysis of the situation, and one that I know we all want to think about a lot more. We don't have time today, but we all need to go read your books, I think, right away. That's the first step. So we will be doing that. And I hope that this can be the beginning of many more engagements between both of you and the Northwestern Buffett community going forward. So thank you very much. And thank everyone for joining today. You can expect we'll send you a link to a survey and an opportunity to sign up for our email listserv if you'd like to know about future events. I will mention the next event in this series will take place on Tuesday, November 3rd at 12 p.m. And this will be Northwestern University Professor of Law Paul Gauder, together with Dmytro Volk, Associate Professor at the Yaroslav the Wise National Law University, and they're going to discuss authoritarian legalism and the potential decline of the rule of law around the world. So that should be very interesting. Thank you again to both of you very, very much. And everyone, be well, stay healthy. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.